Welcome to Shaken and Disturbed, everybody. I am Father God Darren, along with Mother God John Thrasher. And we have, if you're watching this on video, we've got new backgrounds. We're in a new recording setup. We have kind of changed a few things around. So hopefully you can hear us and see us better. How you doing, Johnny boy?
I'm doing well. We're trying our best, guys. If this works, we're going to keep it going for a while. We're using, for those of you who like the tech stuff in the background, we're using Riverside for the first time. So if you have any tips or tricks, let us know, because did we just record a whole NMR and have to scrap it? Maybe, but that's neither here nor
there. Definitely, but you know what? We're going to try and make up for it at some point, and we're going to hopefully make sure that you guys don't know which one we had to scrap and redo, and we'll just pretend like it's all new from the beginning. But we have an excellent case this week, and so Johnny Boy is going to kick it right off for us.
Yes. And shout out to Megan, who did the research for this week's episode and most of our other episodes. But we really appreciate Megan. And I just feel like we needed to give her some love. You know, Darren, it's been a minute.
One of us appreciates her. I'll let you guys determine which one likes women more than the other. Just from sexuality based, maybe their own gender, biological sex. So just you guys determine who appreciates Megan more just from those facts alone.
Always and has to make it on. Weird.
I want the I don't want to force feed information to the audience, John.
Okay, fair enough. All right, well, let's get into this week's episode. So Jane Sanders Britton was born in 1945 into a prominent and well-connected family in Boston before growing up in a nearby town of Needham. Darren, do you know anything about these? Any connections to the cases yet?
I don't. I mean, went to camp in Boston, but don't really know any of these, you know. Don't really know any of it. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Just checking in. All right. Jane's father, J. Boyd Britton, served as the vice president of Radcliffe College during a period when the institution functioned as a prestigious women's college closely affiliated with Harvard University in Cambridge. Friends and classmates described Jane as a vibrant and talented young woman who possessed a sharp intellect alongside an adventurous curiosity about the world. Jane spent a great deal of her free time painting, cooking elaborate meals for friends, and playing the organ. Sounds like a good time to me. Sounds like a person I'd like to hang out with.
Yeah, also really cool kind of hobby to be able to play the organ, because those usually aren't things that you have in your house.
Yeah.
So really cool. I love that. I think my uncle can play the organ, actually.
No, yeah, I totally agree. That's really cool.
I know. I thought you might like that. And guys, bear with us because there's a little bit of a delay for us. We're
just
trying to figure out if it's recording or not. So if we sound kind of hesitant, just let us know and we'll try and adjust for future recordings.
Yeah. So Jane attended Harvard University as an anthropology grad student, where she developed a fascination with the cultural practices of ancient societies, especially their burial rituals. By 1969, Jane had built a reputation among professors and colleagues as a serious scholar with a love for fieldwork and research made her stand out in an extremely competitive academic environment. So it sounds like, you know, she was somebody that really put her head into the books and really enjoyed the intellectual kind of stimulation of the time, you might say.
Definitely.
In 1969, Jane lived alone in an apartment building owned by Harvard University, that housed both graduate students and faculty members. Jane decorated the door to her apartment with a sign explaining that she became an archaeologist because she never had a sandbox as a child.
Damn.
So, you know, once she got the into the real world sandbox, she really kind of took that and ran with it. Yeah.
She's one of those people that seems like an oversharer on social media, you know, where they're just like, she's like, well, I became, it's like, no one asked you why you became an archaeologist.
Yeah, no one,
but like, okay, all right. We got it.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And friends later recalled that the cozy apartment reflected Jane's personality, with books and research notes scattered throughout the space.
Sorry, I interrupted you because we were on delay, so I apologize about that. On January 6, 1969, Jane spent the evening with her boyfriend, James Humphreys, a fellow anthropology student who was also studying for upcoming academic exams. Jane and James began the evening by joining friends for a double date at the Acropolis restaurant. And after dinner concluded, Jane briefly returned to her apartment so that she could change clothes before meeting James again for a late night outing. They went ice skating together on Cambridge Common, a popular winter activity for local students. I used to love ice skating. I mean, I'd go like when I was a kid, but even now, like having the opportunity to kind of ice, I mean, obviously very rare in LA, but certainly in New York, it was always really fun. Such a great winter activity. I loved rollerblading. So it kind of all fit into that stuff and I enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, 100%. When I was young, our YMCA was the only one in the country, or at least this is what we were told, that had an ice skating rink in it. So a lot of us would go ice skating on Fridays or Saturdays. It was really fun.
Well, after leaving the skating rink, the couple stopped at Charlie's Pub for a drink before walking back to Jane's apartment building around 10:30 p.m. They spent about an hour relaxing together inside Jane's apartment while discussing their upcoming anthropology general exams before James headed home for the night around 11:30. Shortly after James departed, Jane visited the nearby apartment of her neighbors, Donald and Jill Mitchell. She stayed for about an hour and shared a glass of sherry while chatting casually about her schoolwork and upcoming exams. Jane then left the Mitchells' apartment at approximately 12:30 a.m. and returned to her own apartment for the night. And this moment, the moment that she left the Mitchells' apartment, marked the last confirmed sighting of Jane alive.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. So once she was home, she changed into a blue nightgown and prepared for bed in the privacy of her apartment. The following day, James Humphreys began to grow increasingly concerned when Jane failed to show up for their anthropology exam. James, and again, when you're like really into your books and you're very studious, like not showing up to an exam, like that's probably a big red flag. So James attempted to call Jane repeatedly throughout the morning, but she did not answer any of his phone calls, so he decided to check on her at home. When he arrived at James' apartment building at approximately 12:20 p.m., he found the door to the apartment unlocked. And yeah, not looking good already. So he stepped inside and quickly realized that something was terribly wrong when he saw Jane lying face down on her bed. Now, believing that Jane might be injured or seriously ill, James ran to alert neighbors Donald and Jill Mitchell. Donald returned with James to Jane's apartment and approached the bed where Jane's body had been laying partially covered by a fur coat. Donald lifted the coat from Jane's head and discovered that her skull had been severely fractured and that her face was covered in blood, and it was immediately clear that Jane had been the victim of a very brutal attack. This is like really horrible because it's one thing if like you stumble into like a house or whatever, but the idea that you have to like remove a fur coat to reveal somebody's situation, like to me, that makes it almost 10 times worse. I don't know. There's just something about that I don't like.
Yeah, definitely.
Cambridge police arrived at the apartment at approximately 12:40. Investigators began securing the apartment and documenting the disturbing conditions of the crime scene. A medical examiner conducted an initial examination of Jane's body at the scene and determined that Jane had died from multiple blunt force injuries to the head that caused severe skull fractures and lacerations to her brain. The medical examiner noted that there was no evidence of a prolonged struggle in the apartment, which suggested that the attack likely occurred while Jane was asleep in her bed.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's lying face down in her bed. The door is open. It's the middle of the night. I kind of imagine that this happened while she was asleep in her bed. It was already, you know, she got home approximately at 12:30 in the morning. That really makes sense that this would happen. Well, toxicology tests later revealed that the sherry Jane drank with Donald Mitchell and Jill Mitchell had not yet fully metabolized in her stomach. This evidence allowed investigators to estimate that Jane died shortly after returning to her apartment at around 12:30 a.m. Now, during their examination of the crime scene, investigators discovered red ochre powder scattered across the walls, ceiling, and floor of the apartment, as well as on Jane's body. Investigators also discovered a fragment of what appeared to be a colonial grave marker also placed near Jane's body, which is very interesting.
That's very weird. Yeah.
I don't even know what that looks like, but
I don't think I do either. Yeah.
These unusual details created the initial impression that the killer may have staged the scene in sort of this ritualistic or symbolic manner. Detectives also observed that two windows in the apartment were open despite the cold winter weather. They found no signs of forced entry into the apartment and reported that nothing appeared to have been stolen from the residence. Now, neighbors later told investigators that they heard someone moving on the fire escape connected to Jane's fourth floor apartment during the night of the murder. One witness also reported seeing a tall man running down the street near the building at approximately 1:30 a.m. on the morning that Jane was killed, maybe about an hour after she came home. In the early stages of the investigation, police naturally examined Jane's personal relationships and social circle. Police initially considered James a possible suspect because he was the last known person to spend time with Jane before the murder. Police ultimately cleared James after finding no evidence linking him to the crime, which, okay, that's totally fair. And like, there is nothing, at least from what we're reading, that would link him to the crime. Forced entry is very interesting. Don't know if her windows were locked. She may have forgotten to lock the door. So all these things could also just be a mistake of Jane, as opposed to it maybe being like someone she knew and let in. It could have just been a mistake, but we'll read further.
So investigators also examined rumors involving Jane's faculty advisor and man named C.C. Carl Lamberg Karlofsky, a prominent Harvard professor who was known for his flamboyant personality and imposing presence. Students circulated rumors that Jane and Carl were involved in a romantic relationship, and some rumors even suggested that Jane threatened to expose the alleged affair if Carl did not allow her to pass her upcoming exams. So,
they're going back and forth on each other now. Damn.
Getting a little spicy at Harvard.
Yes.
In 1969, a grand jury actually reviewed the evidence related to Carl, but ultimately declined to indict him in connection with Jane's murder. So just kind of one of those side details that might be interesting to think about as we continue here. Well, Carl actually continued teaching at Harvard for decades afterward, although speculation about his possible involvement had lingered for years. Investigators also looked into another graduate student named Mike Gramley, who had once had tea with Jane during their time at Harvard. Mike became a person of interest after investigators learned that he was suspected in the disappearance of a student in Canada, which I think is worth examining, you know, like...
Certainly, it's something. It's sussy. It's definitely sussy.
Yeah, it's sussy for sure. Mike denied having any romantic relationship with Jane and later developed an intense personal interest in solving the case himself, actually. Over time, Mike began contacting investigators repeatedly and pressuring them for information about the unsolved murder. Mike eventually told author Becky Cooper that he believed another Harvard professor, Lee Parsons, might have been involved in Jane's death. Lee Parsons reportedly had scratches on his hands shortly after Jane was murdered. Lee told friends that the scratches came from a cat. Listen, I have a scratch. Let's see if we can put this right in the...
No one cares, John. Okay. You're not. Oh, you okay. Did something to affect magic, and we know that.
That's pretty much what
happened. We know that. Yeah.
Lee told his friends that the scratches came from a cat, although acquaintances described him as someone who struggled with alcoholism and was prone to volatile outbursts. So how do you get the scratch exactly then? Like, someone's clearly trying to defend themselves, I guess.
Yeah. But
magic in this case was definitely biting me. Mike later claimed that he discovered a box of the red ochre inside a laboratory associated with Lee, and that some of the pigment did seem to be missing.
Red ochre, I mean, I've never even heard of that. So having that be all over the walls and everything, and then, you know, at least connected to this guy, doesn't look good. This discovery obviously intensified suspicion among some researchers and writers who continued to explore the case decades later. Over the following decades, Jane's murder remained unsolved despite continued speculation and investigation. Author Becky Cooper eventually spent more than 10 years researching the case and reviewing thousands of pages of police records, investigative notes, and Jane's personal diaries. In October of 2017, the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab used modern forensic technology to re-examine evidence collected during Jane's 1969 autopsy, forensic analysts were able to successfully develop a male DNA profile from the biological evidence that had been preserved for decades. Yeah, girl. In July of 2018, investigators received notification that the DNA profile matched a man named Michael Sumpter through the National CODIS database. We've talked about CODIS many times.
We love a DNA profile that gets sent to CODIS. Ooh, we love that shit.
Well, Michael Sumpter was a deceased career criminal who had committed numerous violent offenses during his lifetime. Records show that Michael worked only about 1 mile from Jane's apartment during the late 1960s and had also lived in Cambridge as a child.
Interesting. So this is another, it's just interesting where we are in this episode because here are all these people that everyone's like, no, look at him, no, look at him. And it seems to be that there none of these people were even connected to the case as of this point. Well, investigators later confirmed that Michael Sumpter had been convicted of rape in 1975. Forensic testing later linked Michael Sumpter to the murders of Ellen Rutchick and Mary Lee McLean through DNA evidence. We love a DNA profile.
Guys. Love it.
Investigators confirmed Michael Sumpter's identity as a killer by obtaining a DNA sample from his biological brother. The comparison conclusively demonstrated that Michael Sumpter was the individual whose DNA was found on evidence collected during Jane's autopsy. On November 20th, 2018, the Middlesex County DA, I got too excited about DNA and got my acronyms mixed up.
That's right.
The Middlesex County DA publicly announced that the murder of Jane Sanders Britton had officially been solved, which you love to hear, but it doesn't bring back, of course, the pain of the family or, of course, her life. But nonetheless,
and all the years of suffering to try and solve the case. But yeah.
Yeah, you're so right. The DA explained that investigators concluded Michael entered Jane's apartment through an open window before attacking her. During the announcement, the DA also clarified the longstanding mystery surrounding the red ochre found at the crime scene. Well,
this was my initial question, wondering why. Well, investigators determined the powder was likely paint pigment already present inside Jane's apartment that had been accidentally dispersed during the violent assault rather than part of some sort of ritualistic act. Following the announcement, Jane's brother, the Reverend Boyd Britton, released a public statement expressing gratitude to investigators who continued working on the case for nearly 5 decades. Boyd acknowledged that the family finally had answers about what happened to Jane after so many years of uncertainty. Boyd Britton also reflected on the emotional complexity of closure by stating that learning to understand and forgive the man who destroyed their family's life remained a difficult challenge. And I'm always very impressed by people who can do that. I obviously think forgiveness is peace for you. You know, like I think it doesn't change what happened and it doesn't necessarily get them off the hook, but it gives you some sort of peace of mind. But I would imagine that would be so difficult to do.
And I mean, think about the people 5 decades. I mean, think about the people in her family and friends that never got to hear about this.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
All these years later. Well, and also shout out to genetic phenotyping and DNA phenotyping that, you know, we've seen really start happening in this exact time frame. It was like 2016, about 10 years ago, we started hearing about, you know, being able to link people from their like ancestry DNA, information that they were willingly submitting.
Yeah.
That's how we found out about the Golden State Killer and several other cases that we've covered here on the show. So this is a great example of technology kind of, you know, taking over and solving cases that are half a century old.
I was going to say, even though it's too late, I do think that at least cases now, you know, there is a higher likelihood of these cases getting solved because of CODIS, because of the technology that we have, you know, and so hopefully crime itself, at least there will be more closed cases moving forward.
I hope so.
In our history. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that came up on my, like, you know how, like, sometimes your phone or social media will be like, this day in your social media history.
Yeah,
one of the things that came up recently was a tweet or something that I posted about how crazy it is that the JonBenet Ramsey case hasn't been solved based on phenotyping. It's like they have the DNA. They know that it's existing in that locker somewhere in Colorado. Like, why have we not tested that?
There's a lot of sussy things going on with that case. I mean, you have to want to solve it,
Right. That's the number one thing. And I don't think the Boulder Police Department is looking to solve it. So,
Right. And maybe we have to wonder why, but
yeah, maybe.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's a very talk about a sussy case overall. But obviously, guys, let us know
Yeah.
what you think. Jay Thrasher, Carpe Darren, Shaken and Podcast, Facebook fans, hit us up in Patreon, hit us up on all the things, hit us up on YouTube, write us a letter. But we're going to segue to some listener shout outs right now. John, why don't you take the first one?
Yeah, Brooke in our Facebook group, who had recently listened to our reaction to the Netflix documentary The Crash, had some interesting thoughts about the data from the car. Remember, that's the one where the young girl drove her friends into the a brick wall essentially and killed them. She says, quote, "I'm listening now. The black box is the EDR I mentioned a while ago. As a claims adjuster, it was intentional. She survived because they hit the sign first, changing the angle at which the car hit the building. Had she not hit the sign, she probably would have died as well." End quote. And that was a really good point, Brooke, because I hadn't even really thought about how hitting the sign
Would
meant the
throw it
car,
off.
yeah, would throw
Yeah,
the whole trajectory off. Yeah.
I didn't realize that either, and it makes perfect sense now, and I guess it's not
Right.
like she would have known to hit the sign. I mean, unless she was smarter than she comes
Yeah,
across, which I
appears.
don't think that's true. But it does sound like almost divine intervention that that had happened, at least for her to be
For
alive, is what
her,
I'm
yeah.
saying. Well, our lovely friend and longtime supporter of the show, Mitch, shout out Mitch,
Mitts.
commented about our recent episode, Buried in Her Backyard, saying, "The story lives rent-free in my brain. I listened to the audiobook and it was horrifying and just so sad. I just hope that the girls are still healing and enjoying their lives now." Very, very true. Obviously, we wish that as well. Kind of a famous story and just terrifying in and of itself. And if you want to be amazing
Yeah.
like Mitts and get every episode early and ad-free, be sure to join us over on the Patreon page. And what website is that, John?
That would be patreon.com/shakenanddisturbed, or you can click the link in our show notes.
That's right, everyone. Do we have a sign-off this week, John?
We do. It's a little bit shorter of an episode, but thank you guys for listening and sticking with us as we get through some of our technological changes here on the
It
show,
will be
but
better. It will be
it will
better.
be. Each week it'll get better. We'll figure it out. And we love you guys. Take care. Protect your peace. And sending you all big hugs.
And if you haven't seen my Instagram post of the family Snoopy portrait pics,
Oh,
definitely check it out
yes.
at Carpe Darren. Snoopy is the best thing that ever happened to me, and I guess Nadine is as well.
All right. See you guys next time. Bye.
Bye.